You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 60, Space Monkeys and Mimes. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a recap of the Las Vegas convention with our roving reporter, Sarah Van Cleve, a new 15-disc collection of TOS music, the CBS and Netflix renewal, Larry Nemechek's Trekland on speaker, Rod Roddenberry's new podcast, and we debate what costume Greg should wear to next year's VegasCon. Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt to discuss the TNG episode, The Last Outpost. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I'm doing great. I've actually just put in my 20 days notice, so I'll be moving out of the Kent studio and into my third location. In 1 year we've been doing the show, and
Will actually be your fourth location.
That's true.
You had your location in Japan, and this will be your third one in Seattle.
There you go. Okay. So there was Sendai, and then I was in studio for one episode. And then there was my Greenwood basement, and then there's the Kent studio. So then the Capitol Hill studio will be location number 5. So I'm looking forward
to that.
Hopefully there won't be too many kids playing outside.
Right. Yeah. I did want to ask you, is there going to be a stack of mattresses outside your window that the kids can come play on during the show?
There's not that many kids in Capitol Hill, so that I probably don't need to worry about. I'm a little concerned about my roommate who may have, you know, girls in and out, might be watching movies. So I might need to surround myself with mattresses to soundproof it. But we'll see how it goes.
Right.
You know, every location's going to have its own, you know, audio. What do they call it? There's like a character, audio character. So we'll live with it.
Well,
whatever it is.
You know, maybe we can get friend of the show Michael Fisher to loan you his soundproof booth.
There we go. I just imagine he's wherever he's sitting, he just lowers it around him.
That's
just
right.
Like a sky crane, like with the Curiosity Lander, and it just goes, and he's just surrounded with the egg crates.
He can record from anywhere.
He's like there at Las Vegas, like in the middle of the convention floor. It's like, and it's complete silence.
We're going to have to get a whole fleet of those for next year.
Yes. That'll be fun. We'll do our podcast live from the convention floor in our audio, our soundproof booths.
It'll be in the middle of the floor. Yeah. People walking by. They'll see this collection because we're going to have a lot of guests on with
right.
us.
Yes.
You know, we're going to have the whole crew there. We're going to have a really big ready room.
And
there's going to be just this whole collection of these booths in the middle of the floor. And you don't really know what's going on inside.
Nice. Actually, that's not a bad idea. We should just, as a group, we should all be a staff meeting.
Yes.
And we're attached to the conference table. So we have to walk around together.
Oh, that's our costume.
It's like a group costume.
Our group, Trek FM crew, Star Trek Las Vegas 2013, group costume, staff meeting.
Perfect.
I love it. That's what we're going to do. Well, speaking of Star Trek Las Vegas, Greg, I felt like I got a birthday present this weekend when LeVar Burton did a barrel roll on stage.
I was blown away when I heard about this. I wish I could have been there. Okay. I know we didn't originate the barrel roll. I don't even know where it came from. Honestly, it's a meme that has originated and has come out. But I feel like we push it so much, and all my friends know it because of us. There's got to be some bit that we helped create the barrel roll moment at Star Trek Las Vegas.
I would like to think so. Who knows? I mean, we're just a small little show, and this meme has been around. I think you can even type barrel roll into Google and your display will spin around.
Yes,
your search results will spin around. So, but we certainly do our best to support it on the Ready Room. So thank you, LeVar Burton.
Yeah. Keep doing barrel rolls, LeVar. Keep rolling.
Oh, I can see his next show, Reading Rain Roll. Speaking of the kind, a little bit later in news, our roving reporter on location, Sarah Van Cleve, who has been writing very thorough updates and sending photos in, which we've been posting on the site and on Twitter, is going to be calling in and giving us a live recap of what's been going on there.
And I believe she was there for the role, so we can get her personal experience.
So for all of you who tweet that you skip the news, please stick around.
Stick around this time
for the news today. All right, Greg. So let's jump into some news. And first, actually, we have two very nice iTunes reviews this week. Now, we took a week off last week, and a lot has happened. So we're not going to be able to cover all the news that's happened in the Star Trek universe over 2 weeks. So we're just going to do our best to hit a couple of topics here and kind of recap the end of the con as well. In the US iTunes store, Greg, we got a review from Sarek of Vulcan, who gives us 5 stars. And Sarek says, "A top-notch Star Trek podcast. The Ready Room is a lovingly crafted Star Trek podcast that is funny, intelligent, thoughtful, and thought-provoking. Unlike some other podcasts, it avoids vulgarity and holds its subject matter in high regard, while not being afraid to criticize Star Trek when it is due. The hosts appreciate perhaps the greatest strength of Star Trek, its humanism, and its examination of social issues and the human condition. 3 cheers for Chris and Greg for integrating humor, insight, and hard work into their fine podcast."
Yeah, thank you very much. We try to avoid vulgarity. Occasionally, we might slip up a little bit.
Yeah, occasionally. But, hey... it's part of life. It's
what do you do? We just watched a Star Trek episode where Picard says "merde," and that's in Star Trek, and that's pretty bad. So,
I was shocked.
I covered my ears.
Yeah, I did.
I had headphones on, so it didn't really make a difference. But
so, thank you, Sarek of Vulcan. We really appreciate the 5-star review and the very nice comments. Also, in the UK store, Owlies Outside. Gave us 5 stars.
Did he deliver this review by owl?
That's what I thought when I read it. I was picturing, yes, he wrote the review. He attached it to the owl's leg and sent it to us. Owlies Outside says, "I love listening to the Ready Room. It's become part of my daily routine. Get up, get dressed, turn on the Ready Room, have breakfast. Chris and Greg are wonderful, not to mention hilarious presenters. And they're lighthearted, sometimes naughty if Charlene is involved. Outlook on all things Trek makes for a brilliant show. Keep up the good work, guys and gal." So this one's interesting to me because, you know, this is our 60th show, which is kind of hard for me to believe.
Yeah.
But we've done so many shows, and a lot of people are just now finding out about our show. And a lot of those people are going back and they're listening all the way through the back catalog. So they literally can listen like every day for 2 months if they wanted to, which I don't know why anyone would want to hear our voices every day for 2 months straight. But there are some people who are enjoying the discussions.
I do wonder how the news segments hold up. Like, it's like 9 months old news. Are people still, are you able to engage with it?
You got to listen for the probe segments, you know.
That's true.
You got to find out all those different probes that are attacking Earth.
Yeah, if you skip the news, I think you're missing a big part of it. So hopefully people can get by the fact that, yes, we're speculating about the... I went back and listened to an episode where we're talking about the very first time we discovered that there was going to be a next-gen Blu-ray. And it was like it was like 9 months ago. It's like, wow. And now we actually have it here in our hands. So that's kind of cool to hear. It might be actually fun to go back and listen to all the episodes.
Yeah, it is kind of fun to hear. I mean, some of the news, of course, you're like, okay, yeah, I knew about that. Fine. But
right.
When we're speculating, it is interesting to hear how the speculation progresses. Yeah. So
especially when I say, like, before that, they're never going to make a next-gen Blu-ray because it's impossible because they'd have to go back to the negatives and they'd have to recut it all by hand and redo the... And apparently...
They'd have to bring in Mike and Denise. They would have to...
Like all of these things that they ended
that
up
they
doing. Like, I was pretty adamant that there's no way that they would actually do that.
That's right. So everyone, tune in to Greg's new podcast, Future iPhone Speculation, right, with co-host John C. Dvorak.
There's no way they'd ever make an iPhone with a larger screen and a higher resolution and a smaller dock connector. That would never, ever happen.
Never, ever happen.
No.
All right. So again, thank you guys for the reviews. We really appreciate it. And everyone, if you enjoy the show, please drop by iTunes and leave us a rating and review. Let us know what you think. It does help other people find the show, apparently, in the mysterious world known as the iTunes podcast store. So do that. And if you leave a review in a store outside of the U.S., please shoot me a note on Twitter at C. Brian Jones or at Trek FM or at Greg Harbin. And let us know just so we can go check it, because we actually have to go into every store individually to find these things. Okay, Greg, next up. Some real news.
Yes.
I was excited to see this. A 15 CD collection of music from the original series is coming out this autumn.
Right. Finally, it's not just the Star Trek IV Collector's Edition. It's not just the Star Trek Nemesis Collector's Edition. No, this is TOS. This is every last bit of music, from my understanding, every last bit of music recorded for the original series. So, you know, every time there's a hot blonde who appears on the bridge and there's like a flourish of trombones and violins to indicate that Kirk is engaged, that's going to be on the CD.
Yeah, I think it is all here. So many great composers. Alexander Courage, George Durning, Jerry Fielding, Gerald Fried, Sol Kaplan, Samuel Matlovsky, Joseph Mollendore, and of course Fred Steiner.
Right, which there was a Fred Steiner like collection that came out a few months back, but this is going to have him and all the other stuff too.
Yeah, exactly. It looks really amazing, and the packaging is really cool too. I am actually going to order this. I don't buy music physically. I don't even remember the last time when I bought an actual physical CD is. But this one, I actually am going to order.
Yeah.
And it's coming from La La Records. I assume it's going to be like the other releases and it's going to be limited edition. I'm not sure if that's actually been said or not, but
probably
this is going to be on my pre-order list.
I'm hoping it could. I believe in Japan, you don't have yet the Spotify. Which is like a monthly pay. You pay like $10 a month and you get all the music you want to stream. I don't think you have that yet. I think it's Europe and the U.S.
No.
It has actually a lot of Star Trek music. You can go there and get like next-gen music, original series music, music from the movies, and it just streams automatically. I'm really hoping that this gets added to that because I don't know if I can quite... I don't know if I'm going to listen to TOS music enough to justify the purchase, but it's stuff I want to hear. I'd love to listen through and just, you know, sit back with my headphones and listen to all the music.
Yeah, that would be a great option. It's kind of like Netflix for video, right?
Yeah,
exactly. A great option for fans to be able to hear that. I think for me as a designer, I want this set as much for the packaging.
Yeah,
and the booklet. There's a 100-page booklet that Jeff Bond, who is a Star Trek historian and also a music journalist, wrote that's going to be in here.
Man, that's great.
I think I want it for that reason as well, but hopefully it would be on something like Spotify.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it'd be so, really cool.
One thing to note is that this does include music from season 3, which apparently they just never bothered releasing the season 3 music before.
Well, it's not canon, Greg.
That's true.
It's from season 3.
There's going to be people like getting the box and then like cutting part of it out with a saw and junking it. Right. This music is not part of my personal canon.
Oh, well, we don't know yet, you know, pricing or anything on this. So right. Some details are going to come. But if you go over to lalalandrecords.com, you'll be able to find that there. And we'll keep you updated as well when things come out. So, Greg, by the time everyone hears the show, of course, Star Trek Las Vegas will be over. But we do have a treat for everyone. We have our Trek Film roving reporter on the scene, Sarah Van Cleve, calling in from Vegas for us. Hey, Sarah, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Great. So tell us, what's happening over there?
All sorts of stuff. Today was the captain's panel. So Avery Brooks, Kate Mulgrew, William Shatner, and Scott Bakula were all there. And that was tons of fun. Yesterday was the Next Generation cast reunion with pretty much everybody except for Will Wheaton and Patrick Stewart. So that was craziness, as expected. And then there was different parties for like the captain's chair and gold parties and just all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, you were in some of the special, you have a captain's chair pass, right? So you were in the captain's chair party and the dessert party as well, I believe?
Yeah. So on Friday night, it was the captain's chair party at the Voodoo Lounge and nightclub. So all the Trekkies got up to the 50th and 51st floor of the Rio and got to pretty much party. And J.G. Hertzler and Robert O'Reilly, two of the Klingons, played rock and roll music for everybody. And Chase Masterson performed her jazz. So that was really fun. And then last night was a special concert by Avery Brooks playing his jazz music. And then the dessert party had Tim Russ and his band playing. So lots of really talented Trek stars playing music. So,
Now was there Jonathan Frakes playing the trombone? I thought that would be the highlight.
No, I wish he would have. That would have been cool, but no.
Now, how crazy was Avery on the piano?
It was unique. He played kind of, because he's a very unique guy, but he played kind of slowly, but he had an amazing singing voice. Mm-hmm. And he actually brought out a pianist from Canada that he works with a lot. And he was amazing on the piano. And he used like poster putty and clothespins and stuff to make the piano sound different, which was really cool.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Well, that would be quite interesting to see. Yeah, I wasn't really aware of how wacky Avery was until the Captain's documentary that William Shatner made. But seeing that, and then, because he basically did the whole interview while playing piano. It was like, Shatner would ask him a question. Instead of answering it, he would just play a song. It's like, okay, that's how you're doing this. So seeing him on stage, that must have been quite a treat.
It was. It was really cool. And he spent a lot of time explaining kind of what the meaning of every song is and just what music means to him in general. So it was really cool to see his perspective coming from such a great artist like that.
So what's been your favorite panel so far?
Probably the Next Generation cast reunion. Because I don't know if you guys have seen the Family Guy episode where Stewie transports the entire cast in and madness ensues. That's pretty much what it was on stage.
Nice.
They're all just crazy and it was a lot of fun.
Now, I don't think you got a photo or video of it, but you were there, so you did see LeVar Burton do a barrel roll on the stage, right?
I did, and unfortunately, since probably only the first few rows could actually see him do it because it was across the stage, so I couldn't get a picture of it, unfortunately. But
I did want to ask you what led to that. I read the recaps, and you know, I know that someone asked the characters to describe themselves in one word, but still, the lead up to the barrel roll, I mean, it's like, for Greg and me, it's really like a dream come true that LeVar Burton would do a barrel roll on the stage.
Yeah, definitely. Adam Malin, one of the co-owners of Creation, just asked each guest, describe your character in one word. And most of them didn't take the question seriously, of course. But LeVar's answer was just one word is barrel roll. And then everyone's like, do it. And so he just did it. You know, it's pretty cool.
Nice. I'm hoping next year they'll have like a real, like a door that's coming down so he can enter stage and sort of like through the door, like the warp core is about to breach.
That'd be pretty
Absolutely.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, I think it's proof that, now I know we didn't start the meme. It's right. been around, but we have certainly been a huge supporter of it over the past year or so. I'd like to think that LeVar Burton is a big Ready Room fan.
Be nice to believe. Yeah, every time I hear somebody talk about the barrel roll, it's like, I know we didn't originate it, but we talk about it every week.
Well, I'm sure he's heard about it then.
I hope. So you've seen many, many people in costume. Now, one thing that Greg and I have to ask every year is, did you see anyone as a Horda crawling down the hallway, leaving a trail of burned carpet behind them?
I did not see somebody dressed as a Horda, but somebody actually made a Horda from like an RC car.
Oh, great.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then I think it was 2 years ago, I did see somebody who was in a wheelchair and he just made his wheelchair the Horda, and it was really cool.
Nice.
Oh.
So there was something, there was somewhere around like 1,000 cosplayers this year, right?
For the world record, I don't know how many, if anybody in the costume didn't come to the world record, but for the world record, we had 884.
Oh, wow. Okay. So not quite as many as last year, but still quite a few people. So what was your favorite cosplay that you saw this year?
There were a lot. there were quite a few really good Borg costumes that were pretty cool. I know one guy has spent more than a decade working on his Borg costume, so his was amazing, of course, yeah. And then lots of Klingons.
Right. And
well, I think the one that should have won, I think, is the one of the photo that you sent us of the couple that had the Vasquez Rocks hats on with the Gorn and Kirk fighting.
Oh, that's pretty
good. That one is really cool. Definitely unique. So I thought they should have won too.
That was a cool idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw some female Klingons, like TOS female Klingons. I thought that was really cool for people to do. I wish there were more TOS costumes. Like, let's see some flappers from a piece of the action.
There actually were. There were some from a piece of the action.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Those are pretty cool. And there were a lot of next generation costumes, obviously, because this is the 25th anniversary. And part of the costume contest was a special prize for next generation. So the same guy that made the really good Borg costume actually comes every day in different Data outfits, and he looks almost exactly like Brent Spiner as Data.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Is that the shot of him with the cat holding Spot? Because my daughter has that same cat, except hers is completely white, that like a toy cat. I saw that. There's the cat. So have you spent any time in the vendor's room?
I did. I spent quite a bit of time there. And there's pretty much everything you could possibly want that's Star Trek related in there.
What's the most unusual thing that you've seen?
I see a lot, like hundreds and hundreds of collector's plates, mostly with the Next Generation characters on them, which I thought was kind of different. I don't know, like just a lot of phasers and that was, I mean, I don't really find any of it that strange just because, you know, I'm so into it, but there's just a lot of really cool, there's original props and costumes for sale and just all sorts of stuff.
Nice. I did see one shirt that I really liked. It's the Batleth Man
logo. I saw that. Yeah.
I actually had somebody pick up one of those for me.
Oh, really?
I saw the picture. It's actually for a friend, but it's like, I must have that shirt. It's perfect.
Yeah, that's really cool.
I'm thinking for next year, we need to commission our own line of unusual products like the Ferengi toothpaste or something like that that we'll sell.
Definitely. That'd be really cool.
All right. So tell us, what are your plans here as the show wraps up?
Well, I actually have a 6 a.m. flight out of Vegas tomorrow morning. So, and pretty much everything is over now. So I'm just kind of hanging out until my flight.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you covering everything for us. And for listeners, if you haven't already read them, I mean, go to the Trek FM site, go to the Captain's Log Journal under articles, and we have all of Sarah's recaps, full write-ups with the photos and everything there by day by day. So you can really find out in detail everything that was going on. And all the tweets too, Sarah, you've been doing a great job of keeping us up to date on all the details of what's happening in the panels.
Thank you. I do have one more really cool thing I thought I'd like to add. There's a slushy bar in the Rio, and they have a blue slushy, and they named it Romulan Ale for this weekend.
Oh, nice.
So that's great. I thought that was pretty cool. I was excited about that.
For a minute there, I thought you were going to say that Tim Russ tried to order a soy slushy and it didn't come on time. And all hell broke loose.
The girl that was working at the slushy bar was like, I tried to get them to get blood wine and Cardassian sunrises, but they wouldn't do it. And I was like, oh,
they should, especially Cardassian sunrise. Come on.
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
Yeah. And I thought it was just cool that the Rio kind of embraces the convention and welcomes everybody. So.
Yeah, that is great. All right, excellent. Well, we're looking forward to having you join us sometime when you're not on the road, and talk about things and your future contributions to everything at Trek FM too.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity. So, thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Sarah.
Well, Greg, that was great to get an actual call in from the con.
Definitely.
So, and as we've talked about already in the news here, we're going to try to be there ourselves next year. And we're actually going to try to get the whole Trek FM crew there. Thankfully, Drew has kind of spearheaded an effort to, get us all there.
Right.
I love the idea we came up with at the beginning of the show today of us all going in one costume as a staff meeting. But I also you've proposed a new poll for Trek FM, Greg. You want to know what costume should Greg wear to Star Trek Las Vegas 2013?
Right.
And why don't you give us the options, Greg?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this and a few days ago, and I was iMessaging about it. So yeah, I came up with a few ideas that I think I could pull off after a little bit of design work. So the first one, first idea, Scant. Be my science Scant.
That's a real classic right there. Classic season one TNG look, yeah.
Classic, classy. Lots of things like that. So yeah, vote for that one. Number two would be the whale probe from
okay,
Star
I love
Trek
this
4.
One. Now, do you think it would be difficult for you to walk around as the whale probe?
From the shame? No, I think you mean just because it'd be so large, right?
I'm picturing this extending far out from your stomach and your back.
Yes, and my back, yes. I'd have to have, people around me in a wide load, sort of pushing people out of the way. I'd start boiling the oceans. It'd be very messy, but whale probe, that could
be. Every time you walk by the coffee shop or something, the water starts evaporating. Yeah. It could be a real
perfect
problem.
Number three is one that I think Jordy, LeVar Burton, will be a big fan of. I would just go as a barrel roll.
Now, this is the one I'm really thinking of voting for, because when you told me this one, my first image was on The Big Bang Theory when Sheldon went to Penny's party as the Doppler effect.
Right, yes.
I love this kind of abstract motion or effect or some concept that it's requires movement, so it's very difficult for you to recreate it in a stationary form.
Yeah. I'm going to really need to draw on the work of the futurists to sort of show motion, even when I'm standing still, waiting in line for Chase Masterson's autograph. I still needed to show people that I'm barrel roll. Like somebody was there as space.
That's good.
And I still don't get it, but so that one I'm going for. And I think I would also need to have a little thing I could just click. Just anytime I'd be walking around, I would click, do a barrel roll.
Make it a button on your back so people can walk up to you and tap you on the back.
And just hit it. That's perfect. Like a big red button.
So what's the next option?
Number four is kind of gender bending. Number four is Empress Hoshi.
Well, of course. I mean, you've already got the outfit right over there behind you on your statue.
Behind me on the statue. So I just have
to
wear it.
I wish the listeners, could see the video feed here.
Yeah, I think the only issue will be me really passing as a 5'2" Asian woman. But I think with enough time and preparation and planning, I think I could do it.
Yeah. For those who don't know, Greg, you're 6'2". How tall are you?
Yeah, I'm about 192 centimeters. I'm about 6'4". Yeah.
6'4", yes. So,
one of the taller people you'll meet. I'm thinking of just going as James Cromwell, although I think he actually has a couple inches on me.
That would work. All right. Well, what's our fifth option?
Fifth one. This is one I'm actually hoping for. Fifth one is Admiral Adama's desk.
So say we all.
Just the whole thing. Chair, mahogany chair, finish.
Which, again, is another prop that's sitting there in your room.
Yes, it is. I don't know how I fit reference. It in here.
I don't know how you get it in there either. But no. So are you going to cut a hole in it and just kind of climb up inside?
Well,
or?
The actual desk would probably be a little too heavy for me to lift and walk around in all day. So I'm probably going to have to make like a styrofoam replica, sort of how they do in the original series.
So you're going to spray paint it like they
would?
Yeah,
it'll be spray painted. Yeah.
Okay.
So I will look like the desk. Like, it won't even be me sticking out. I will be inside of it, sort of like Kenny Baker inside of R2-D2.
Okay. Well, it'll be great. I mean, in the future, you can go to cons and you can introduce yourself as Admiral Adama's desk, and people will want your autograph. And
I'm sure they will.
You can go on cruises. All right. All the BSG cruises, of course.
All the BSG cruises, right.
Yeah.
And, okay, number six is the final one, the one I'm probably most proud of. It is the band 5-Year Mission.
The whole band.
The whole band. All of them. Mike, Fark, Chris, Patrick, LeVar, Worf,
yeah.
Laverne. Yeah, all of them. Yeah. Yeah, so that'll be my reference for the band. I mean, if people can go as Vasquez Rocks with the Gorn and Kirk in combat, I think I can go as the band 5-Year Mission.
So I don't know which one I'm going to vote for, to be sure, but we're going to put this poll on Trek FM. We're going to tweet this out. We're going to find out, and we're going to put a write-in on there as well. We're going to let our listeners choose your costume for next year's convention. All right, so everyone.
I feel like there should be some fine print that I'm not necessarily going to be bound to do what you guys choose for me to do. But it will certainly be taken into consideration as I plan Operation Vegas for next year.
That's what we call the Charlene clause, right?
So, yes.
Because who knows what she's going to tell you to go as.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil what's coming in the future. We did a time travel this week. But there's something she could suggest that I'm not sure if I'm quite on board for.
So we'll find out about that. All right, so moving along, Greg, we have a few stories we want to just touch on here fairly quickly. One of them, which I think most Star Trek fans will be very glad to hear, is that Les Moonves and CBS have agreed to extend their relationship with Netflix.
Yeah.
And so Star Trek will continue to be available to
Netflix.
Everyone.
Netflix, a.k.a. the Star Trek box. My PS3 is basically used for turning on Netflix so I can turn on Star Trek. So if it ever went away, I would be angry. I would be sore. I wouldn't know what to do with my Sunday afternoons.
Well, never fear. You're going to keep it. So yours is like my PlayStation 3 is known as the NCAA football box because it's the
exactly.
only...
right.
Despite the fact that we have a binder with like 50 games in it, it's actually the only thing that ever gets played on that machine. So
yep. And you know, I keep every couple weeks I talk to somebody new who tells me even though they're not a Trekkie, they're going back, they're watching Next Gen, they're watching DS9, they're watching Voyager for the first time. The fact that it's on Netflix is such a boon to Star Trek fandom. It's if it ever went away, if they ever lost the deal, I honestly think CBS could offer their own streaming platform and charge $10 a month, and people would still do it.
Oh, they would, absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's a very smart move by CBS to do this. So I'm glad that
a smart
they
move
see...
by Netflix to keep it on there too, because it's really the only thing keeping me having a Netflix subscription.
Yeah, I would probably have a Netflix subscription for that, even though I have all the DVDs. But still, like I could watch like just on the go anytime would be
yeah.
would be awesome. Yeah. If I could get Netflix in Japan, which we sadly cannot.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And still, sadly, no news on when the HD restoration will be making it onto Netflix. But hopefully, we'll certainly let you guys know once we know more about that. I've been trying to reach out and get comments from anybody, but nobody seems to know yet.
I think it'll be a while. I just think they would be shooting themselves in the foot if they put it on there too soon. So
I mean, they're trying to sell them for like $60, $70, $80 a pop, you know, per season. I imagine they're going to have a year, 2 year gap before those start making their way onto the streaming services.
Yeah, that's what I would expect too.
Chris, I want to ask you about this project you worked on with Larry, leading into Star Trek Las Vegas this year. I had no idea. This sort of came out of left field, this Trekland on speaker.
Yeah, this was fun. I mean, it's something we decided to do really close to the convention. So we put it together really quickly. But Greg, as you know, because Larry shows us, you know, when we're doing the show sometimes, he's got this boxes and boxes of audio cassette tapes in his studio of interviews that he has done over the years. I mean, they go back into the mid-80s with not only the actors, but, you know, the directors, assistant directors, creative team. Just, it's like everything you can think of from Star Trek.
It's great because he was there, so he knows who was really involved. And especially in those early years of TNG, where they sort of had a revolving door of producers. I mean, Larry was there. Larry was talking to these people, and he's got these tapes. I mean, he talked with Bob Justman, and I think that's one of the interviews that's on here, that like you never hear from Bob Justman. Everyone always wants to talk to Gene, and then once Gene was gone, they want to talk to Rick Berman. And those are like the only thing we hear. So, but Larry's got so much of the behind-the-scenes information.
It is. It was really interesting to me listening to these interviews as we were putting the disc together. And the information, I mean, it's stuff that's never been heard before. A lot of this stuff's just never been out there anywhere. It hasn't been in the books. And so, you know, it's not on Memory Alpha right now either. The first disc that Larry selected to sell at the convention, which of course you won't be able to get your hands on this one, but it was a special release for the convention. There are four interviews, and there's one from Mark Leonard. There's one, like you said, from Bob Justman. There's one with the Jerry Fleck, and there's one with Michael Piller. Mm. And the information in there, it's really fascinating hearing, like from Mark Leonard, hearing about how he got involved in Star Trek and what it's meant to him. And the interview is coming from 1986, I believe it is.
Right.
So hearing it now too, and hearing Mark Leonard talk about the conventions and how the fans are embracing Star Trek at that time, it's still in its early stages of what we now know is this, you know, just enormous phenomenon. So it's really fascinating.
Yeah. Hearing some of that stuff at the time, I mean, I just picked up the Larry's book, The Next Gen Companion. And hearing what was going on, I mean, when was it written? 92 or 93, I think. So it's right before DS9 started. And hearing the perspective on Star Trek at that like moment in time is really cool, because DS9 hadn't started, definitely no Voyager, no TNG movies. All we had was TOS and then a few seasons of Next Gen. And it's kind of cool to have like this little time capsule. So it wouldn't be the same if Larry was conducting new interviews. It's really cool that there are these old interviews that all he can do is just show us what it is. Sort of, I'm sure they're edited, but not through the lens of 20 and 30 years of, you know, how are we shaping the story? It's just sort of the raw data.
Yeah, and when Larry is hoping to begin releasing more of these, that's the concept behind Trekland on speaker. And even though this disc, which is a physical disc that we designed and put together, was available at the con, 50 copies were available. Hopefully future ones find different ways, you know, for people to get their hands on them so everyone can hear these interviews. And there are so many of them. So stay tuned is all I can say right now. I just kind of wanted to let people know that this was coming about and to watch for it. So Larry's site is treklandblog.com. That's Larry Nemechek's Trekland. And, you know, keep an eye on there and you'll find out, you know, what he's planning to release and what's coming up. So very exciting.
Yeah, very cool. And another, there's another bit of audio-ness in the Star Trek world that was announced this week, which is a podcast from Rod Roddenberry, which this actually, this really surprised me, but kind of excites me.
Yeah, it's good to see Rod putting together an actual podcast for Star Trek, because, of course, Rod has his own perspective as the son of Gene Roddenberry, as we found out, you know, through Trek Nation coming out as well. And one of the wonderful things about Star Trek is being able to get so many different perspectives on what the franchise is, because it means so much to so many different people. So this one is called Mission Log, and it is produced together, Roddenberry Entertainment and The Nerdist, I believe, are putting it out. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be hosted by Ken Ray, who many of our listeners probably know from his show, macOS Ken, mm-hmm. and also John Champion from DVD Geeks.
Right.
And they're going to be together. And then Rod is going to be on from time to time. I don't think Rod's actually going to be on every episode, but
now,
he's going to be coming
in. Now, is Ken Ray, is he the racial Ray from the Dork Trek podcast?
I don't think so, Craig.
No, I know. I think he's quite different from Rachel Ray. And what I'm actually interested to see is sort of a different perspective, because they're going to be going through the original series and doing it sort of episode by episode in order, starting with The Cage.
Right.
And I imagine they're going to have more of a serious perspective on things than, say, Dork Trek.
Or us.
Or us.
Sometimes we're serious, but not always.
Right.
Yeah, they are. I think that's the idea. I think the way Trek Nation explored fandom and the philosophy and, you know, deeper meaning behind mm-hmm. Star Trek, this is a podcast. They're going to explore that subtext, they call it, of
that complex, you know, metaphors.
Right. That's the description they gave of it.
Brain and brain. What is, like, seriously? No, I'm serious right now. Think with me. What is brain?
I'm not sure, but it sounds like in the background right now, the brain is being transported by ambulance to somewhere.
It is.
But yeah, I can't wait to find out what the complex metaphor behind Spock's brain really was. But yeah, they're going to be doing this. So I've downloaded the first episode last night. I'm looking forward to listening to it. And not only are they going through TOS, Greg, but they are going through all six series, so including right. the animated series, in chronological order that they aired. So they're starting with The Cage, and they're going to end with what allegedly I've heard is the final episode of Enterprise, called These Are the Voyages. They're going to go all the way through.
Not part of my personal canon.
So I think now, I saw someone post that this is a podcast with an expected lifespan of 13 years. That's
oh
how
God.
Long it would take to get through. I don't know.
I'd like to see. Are there any podcasts that old? It's possible. Like Twit has got to be like 6 or 7 years old by this
the
point.
The oldest podcast that I personally listen to, so I doubt it's the oldest podcast around, but it is one. It's from the very early days, is Adam Christensen's MacCast. I don't know
right,
if you
yeah.
listen to the MacCast, but I've been listening to Adam since I think it's 2004.
Wow.
So, and I am always amazed that he has had this podcast going as long as he has, but...
Yeah, and that's probably before they were even called podcasts.
I think he started, it was right when, before there was really a podcast area in the iTunes store or anything,
yeah.
so...
Yeah. I mean, I knew people who were making a podcast in, like, 2002, but they only lasted, like, 15 episodes.
Yeah, right.
So, if they actually go for 13 years... I'll be quite astonished. There'll probably be a new show by then that they can just start doing new episodes about.
Oh, there would have to be, yeah. So after Enterprise, then they'll do the whole... The new show will have come and gone.
Yeah,
possibly.
True.
And then you'll put that in. All right.
So that'll be interesting to see.
So that's our quick recap of a few things that have happened in the Star Trek universe over the past 2 weeks. And next week, we'll bring you more.
Here we come, walk down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys,
And people say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We go where we want to, do what we like to do. We don't have time to get restless.
In the fourth episode of the first season of The Next Generation, we were introduced to what was meant to be the big new threat to the Federation, the Ferengi, who I like to lovingly refer to as the Space Monkeys. But that was in The Last Outpost. It was a very interesting episode, to say the least, and we're going to talk about that today, both the episode and the remastering, now that the Season 1 Blu-ray set is out. And to do that, of course, Greg is here, and joining us is everyone's favorite friend of the show and Voyager editor, Charlene Schmidt. Hello, Char.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Welcome.
Now, Char, we got a review that we read during the news today on iTunes, and they actually mentioned how our show goes a little bit naughty when you're on.
Oh, really? Whatever are you talking about?
I don't know. I've never noticed, but it's not like anything's happened in past podcasts or...
No, never. And it's not like you guys bring it out of me at all.
Hey, we are completely innocent here. Don't try to blame anything on us.
Hey, I don't really do this on other podcasts, so I don't know what gives.
It's just our show.
I guess so.
You guys are special.
I
remember. You bring out the best in me.
I think here we've found a show where there's no sex whatsoever, unless I'm... missing something somewhere.
Well, okay, and that's one thing is you always have me on for the sex episodes.
Right.
Yeah. That's
with
true.
This, we're gonna talk about females wearing clothing.
That's right.
That's true. That's true.
That's right.
Did you see the girls at the Star Trek Las Vegas wearing their Ferengi female costumes?
Yes, I
they
sure
had black
did.
Bars over the naughty bits and says censored.
I did not see that.
That was pretty good.
That was good. That's one of the better costumes I saw.
I have to go find that. Oh, by the way, Char, did you figure out what I meant last night when I told you that when you look at the cosplay photos that Sarah sent from Las Vegas that you might throw
what?
Up in your
okay.
mouth a little bit?
No, I did not figure this out. What are you talking about? I feel bad because it's probably so obvious, but no, I did not.
What kind of person would cosplay as Kai Wynn?
Oh, okay.
Come on.
I don't want to say anything mean because I don't know the person who came in costume.
No, and I'm totally
I'll
kidding.
I'll keep my mouth shut on that one. I don't want her writing in. I can't believe what you said on the ready room.
I know. As I told you, though, I said it's not the person and it's not the costume because it's beautifully done. It's just the choice of character. It's like,
why would you be Kai Wynn?
Why would you be Kai Wynn?
There's so many options.
Be Kai Opaka. Well, I liked Kai Opaka.
Yeah, there you go.
But she pulled off so well, I overlooked it, I guess.
I love it when people on my Twitter feed who aren't, you know, I follow a lot of Trekkies, so I'm used to seeing a lot of Star Trek, but there's a few people that I don't expect to see anything about Star Trek with, and that's this guy Dude Hugs, and he just was just randomly tweeting, watching DS9, you know, Kai Wynn's a really terrible person, you know that?
Right.
Like, yes! Join us, Dude Hugs.
Oh, man.
That's a great handle, by the way.
Oh, he's
Dude
awesome.
Hugs?
Oh, it is.
That's
Dude
great.
Hugs. Yeah.
Follow Dude Hugs, everyone.
All right. Well, let's see. If I rewind a little bit, I think I said we were going to talk about the TNG episode, The Last Outpost here. So our listeners
right,
are probably
so.
Wondering
oh, yeah,
when we're going
right.
to get to it. So let's just talk about it. I watched this episode last night, and I decided not to live tweet my viewing because I wanted to save some of my comments for the show today. I was watching through and I was marveling at the remastering because there's so much beautiful stuff in the HD. I was really amazed at like the underside of the Ferengi ship when it turns, for one thing. It was just astonishing, the detail work in the model. And the episode was going so well. And then we get down to the planet and I lost it. And
yeah.
Oh, man. What did you think, Greg? You've watched it in HD.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to start out talking about the HD. And you think about it, this is episode, what, four? Like,
four.
They made the pilot.
It was the
and then there was Naked Now.
Where no one has gone before.
Where no one's gone before.
Code
and then
of
this
Honor,
one, right?
I believe.
Code
right.
of Honor. So this is episode four of the actual show. And they've already abandoned their idea of, we're going to use just the stock shots. Like, that was their idea. They're going to have ILM make these shots for the pilot, and then they were just going to reuse them for the whole first season. But no, you already have the writers writing in another ship, a space battle. It's basically impossible for them to reuse any of the shots from the pilot in this one.
Yeah, well, this was the sixth episode produced and fourth released, but either way, it was really quick. Yeah, that they go in for more shit. But thank goodness they did. I mean, how boring would the show be if every shot we saw was some selection from 24 stock shots that they had or something?
Right. Yeah. Which, if you do notice, they use the same Enterprise flying towards camera shot to open pretty much 3/4 of the series.
Yes, they do. I know.
So that's a problem. But no, I love seeing these shots, especially in HD. The Ferengi ship looks really cool. I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, they did a really good job designing the Ferengi ship. You know, it's not covered in fur and using a whip. It's really kind of dangerous and threatening looking.
Oh, how cool would it have been, though, if the ship were covered in fur, and instead of phasers or photon torpedoes, it had those giant whips that went out, and then the laser came out of the whip?
That'd be pretty awesome.
That would be amazing.
So, Char, speaking of that, do you think that all starships should have whips as weapons?
Just kidding. Okay, now this is what I'm talking about here.
No, I'm telling you, we're in.
This is where I'm worried. We're going to start getting Charlene talking about whips, and we're going to go down some whole other.
It's all downhill from here, guys.
Oh, gosh. No, seriously, well, okay, though, what are your impressions? Remember back, think back to the first time that you saw the Ferengi. It's hard because, you know, we know the Ferengi from Deep Space Nine, and they were turned into a pretty well fleshed out society that made sense and was, you know, you could accept them for who they were. But here, when you go back in hindsight and watch it, I actually was thinking when I was watching that in hindsight, all of this dramatic build up to the Ferengi in this episode is really hard to swallow.
I agree with you. This is a very rough draft version of what we came to know as the Ferengi, and it is hard to watch, and I think your description of sea monkeys is quite apt. What is with this weird crawly thing they do, and they over-gesture everything, and they speak like this? What is that?
It's not just the speaking. It's the hands and the...
Yeah.
When you see it,
it's everything.
Oh, man. That's exactly. I wish the listeners could see what Greg is doing right now.
Yeah, Greg's kind of walking around like some weird zombie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's even weird because, okay, they obviously have described the Ferengi as Yankee traders, as the worst part of capitalists.
Yes.
So why, but then when they actually are using them in this episode, they're treating it like they're the Klingons or the Romulans. A big warrior race. Like, I guess the Klingons would be the most apt description. Like, the Ferengi are going to be the Klingons in this show.
Well, that was the intention. They were going to be the replacement as the big villain for the show.
Right. Yeah. So why describe them as capitalists? Why say that they're traitors? Because the way they're trying to... I mean, that's where they go with it. And that's really cool. Because what I like about the Ferengi is they're a different kind of alien. They're not the same sort of warlike race. They're going to come at it from a whole different angle. So it's really kind of impressive that they had that concept up front, but then they undercut it by trying to make them dangerous for some reason.
Well, the reason is that they were supposed to be the replacement for the Klingons in the series. They were going to be the big villain, but as everyone knows now, the introduction was such a disaster that there's no way they could continue. So then they developed the Borg to replace the Ferengi, but the Borg, there was no budget to do the Borg originally, so that they don't show up until halfway through the second season, and then they don't really show up until the end of the third. But
I mean, there's
not
really a consistent villain for TNG. Like, it kind of fell apart.
That's why you have energy villain of the week, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And watching TNG as a block, it sort of feels like a problem, especially coming off of DS9, and you always have the Dominion threat, especially later in the series. Go back to to TNG, and they never have that. And I do wonder if it all just goes back to the fact that Last Outpost fell apart, and they said, you know what, let's not even try to have a recurring villain now.
I don't know.
Of course, TOS didn't have a recurring villain either, so really.
Right, not really. I mean, you think of the Klingons as that, but the Klingons really didn't appear that often in TOS.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, no, they really didn't. But I do wonder, Greg, if that train of logic is exactly what happened, because that makes a lot of sense. They were going to have this major adversary. It flopped. Okay, now what do we do?
Right. Yeah, I mean, and they've been setting up the Ferengi too, right? I think they
even
mentioned them
missions.
In the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean...
We hope the Ferengi don't find you as tasty as their last...
right.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But I mean, okay, aside from the Ferengi flopping, which kind of comes late in the episode, just talking about the setup of the episode, it's an interesting concept. I think you mentioned, Chris, the overlong captain's log at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
It's supposed to be sort of like a tweet that he's making. This one comes more across as like a blog post. Like, they stole something or another, and we didn't see them, and this gives us a great opportunity to actually see them in the flesh, and this is very exciting, and I can't wait to see it.
It is. Like, it's okay, really long. Okay. Yeah, it is like a blog post. It's like Picard's being paid by the word for his captain's log.
Yeah, it's like, you know, page 2, page 3.
Right.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, he's getting ad impressions for every paragraph. It is like that. I mean, it doesn't really bother me because I like the talkiness of Star Trek. It's one reason I like the first season of Enterprise, even though a lot of people say it's like really slow and talky. But when you're used to later TNG, where Picard really like gets in and out, it's like one or two sentences. Here's where we're going. It's actually, you know, text expander, how you can have, you type it in and like in the new text expander 3 and 4, it'll put a blank and you can fill in something.
Yeah.
Picard, his captain's log, he does like CPE for captain's log entry and he hits the delimiter. And it puts
like
out
hash star date.
Exactly. It puts in the star date. He fills it in. And then it says, we are transporting diplomats to a conference on.
Yeah.
And then there's a blank. And you put in the name of the planet. So when you're used to that.
It saves them a lot of time.
It does.
Yeah.
And when you're used to that and you go back to this one, it really does feel like it goes on and on.
But then we have this really cool thing, and Charlene, I want to know what you feel about just the beginning of the episode, because you do have the Enterprise matched up against a ship of similar size. When you think of The Last Outpost, you don't think of this, but it does have this opening that is a kind of cool, like, stalemate situation.
That's true. Yeah, it kind of reminded me of just good old classic TOS, that confrontation with an unknown alien. You don't know what they're going to do. They present themselves as a pretty threatening adversary, so what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And it seemed like a pretty fair matchup. And, of course, they talk about this on the bridge. We don't know a whole lot about them, but we think they have similar technology to ours in terms of advancement, blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, here we go. I thought that was done well.
And this is where Data says that the reports conflict, and Riker freaks out. Well, which reports don't conflict, damn it?
Yeah, he's yelling throughout this episode for no good reason.
Come on, Riker.
Use your indoor voice, Riker. Yes. Indoor voice.
That's good. That's why Picard was already really pissy with him in Encounter at Farpoint when Riker comes onto the battle bridge.
Right.
Maybe so.
I can just see Picard with him now. Like, he takes Riker off to the ready room. And like you said, use your indoor voice when you're on the bridge, number one.
Yeah, number one.
But yeah, I had the
note. He does it later. Obviously, we're going to talk about Geordi. But when Geordi comes up with his brilliant plan, he starts running around engineering. You got Riker. I don't know what he's doing, but he's like off screen. He just yells, yeah, go ahead and do that, Geordi.
What? Yes.
Where'd you wander off to?
That's what I was wondering. Was he walking out of engineering just because there was a solution to the problem? Or was he really yelling at Geordi that loud?
Yeah, because he's
like right off camera.
Yeah, he leaves engineering. The doors are still closing. And then he hears Geordi with, yeah, just do that. Whatever.
Yeah.
That's when he gives him the thumbs up, right? Woo-wee! Thumbs up.
Yeah. Geordi in this episode is a trip. I mean, he's making these random comments. My favorite Geordi moment, I mean, okay, you gotta love the, you know, kick hard into warp nine, woo-wee! That's fantastic. But my favorite moment is when they're in the conference room and Data has the Chinese handcuffs.
Yeah.
And Jordy's just like, my hero.
Oh, it's I
like,
know.
What? That's such a... What? That's really cussing mean of you, Jordy.
Well, you know, they picked that back up later on in Voyager when Rainn Robinson says, my hero.
Yes, she sure
does.
That's
true.
That whole scene
with the Chinese handcuffs there is... It's really something, because I'm sitting there and I'm marveling at the holographic display, because in HD, you can really see all the details as they learn about the T'Kan Empire. And then
they remade the display for this version.
Okay.
But it's exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
So
yeah.
But it's just higher resolution. So it is really cool. Like, I think that's one of the things Mike Kakuta really worked on, like, originally, but even now, it's a really cool looking display, showing little bits of information,
yeah.
And it's rotating in 3D. It's a pity they couldn't move the camera around it, but yeah. It still looks really cool.
It looks fantastic, and I'm watching that, and then suddenly Data's got his finger stuck, and then the rest of the crew, the bridge crew, they're like laughing under their breath, and I'm like, this is serious, guys. We're trying to find out this empire.
Yes.
Oh, but just to backtrack just a minute there, what you were talking about, Char, is that, you know, I think that the introduction of the Ferengi, I mean, I agree, Greg, that trying to mix the Klingon warrior race with the Yankee trader and the capitalist things a little bit odd, but I think you could probably bring that all together and make it work. I think that Daemon Tarr on the view screen and his conversation with Picard, for the most part, was handled quite well. And at that point, I'm okay with the Ferengi, and I'm thinking, okay, yeah, they're just as good as a lot of the races.
His appearance on the view screen works for you. He's, your visages offend me. I can't watch that bit without just cracking up.
I think that the makeup, the design overall was okay. The presentation was overall okay. Now, I did burst out laughing later on when he comes back on the screen, and the very first thing he says is like, your alien imagery shocks us again.
Yeah. Yes. And what's with them so close up in the screen?
Right. He's like right there next to the screen. I guess that's, he's supposed to be like trying to exaggerate his size, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
So he's had them bring the camera close to him.
Because
look at my lobes.
I think it's Troy. Troy makes a comment like he's hiding something and the image he is sending has been distorted or something like that.
Yeah, I've never quite understood what they were going for.
Yeah, I think that the writers were going for one thing and then the effects team just didn't do anything to the image to make it, I don't know. But the view screen in the HD too is really amazing because you finally feel like, yeah, on the Enterprise, they do have this like super high definition holographic screen.
Yeah, it finally feels like you believe that it's 3D, which is really cool.
And it's really there,
like,
yeah.
You know, you watch the new film, you know, Space Adventure 2009, and you feel that the screen's got the 3D-ness to it. But then you go back and it's like, oh, well, no, they were kind of going for that here too, which is kind of cool. And when it's in the HD, yeah, even more.
Yeah, yeah, it does work. So up until this point, you know, I'm kind of okay with it. And I think that the episode itself, the concept of the episode is pretty good. It's very Roddenberry.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of commentary on Earth society. Picard goes on the bridge about this whole bit about the colors. It actually kind of lost me at one point where they go into the colors. And they're like, yes, red, white, and blue for the United States or for France.
Well, that's right.
At a time when nation states were important and in conflict with one another. And
right. Yeah, it was weird. I did finally get a bit from it. Cause I picked up Larry Nemechek's book this week. I actually found it at a used bookshop, the Next Generation Companion. And he mentions in there that they were going to try to make a running joke of Picard having this French heritage.
That's right. Yeah.
Similar to the jokes about Chekhov in Russia back in TOS.
That's right.
But they kind of drop it immediately. There's like one other time it comes up. So the fact that he's standing there, you know, all at attention and more properly in the order, whatever order it is, blue, red, and white. It's like, what are you, Picard, really? This is like a serious situation.
So at some point he's going to come on the bridge and he's going to go, "This is the captain speaking. We've decided to change security and engineering uniforms to white. We will now have blue, red, and white uniforms on this ship only. No more gold. This is not Germany.
We've got enough rats.
This is not Spain."
Right, exactly. Yeah, I just wanted to see him go down to the planet and explain to them, "You know, France was the first person to introduce the laser whip."
Exactly.
Of course they were. Of course.
Exactly. That is exactly what they were going for.
Right.
But I see where they were going with it, and it's very Roddenberry, and it's very Star Trek, you know, this whole commentary of how as a society by the 24th century, you know, Earth has moved beyond this bickering of nation states. And so that's all in there. And, you know, if you love Star Trek and you love TOS, especially, there's a lot in this episode that carries that forward. While at the same time, they're trying to kind of chart their own course. I actually have in my notes, 12:44, staff meeting.
Yes.
Staff meeting.
Perfect.
Classic. Fourth episode into the series, and we're having a staff meeting to discuss the problems.
Yeah.
So very happy to see that.
They didn't call it a staff meeting. What did they call it?
Conference. Yeah, it was like a conference.
Yeah. He doesn't call it a staff meeting. He calls it something else. But
yeah, but I noticed when I was watching the show. Yeah. I was noticing when I watched the show, it didn't matter what he called it. It was still staff meeting is what played right. in my head immediately. Exactly. Like, I don't even care what you actually said, Patrick.
It's conference evaluation, just for the record.
That's
I put it in my notes.
Wow, conference evaluation.
Man,
yeah, what kind of weird, twisted, politically correct 80s term is this? Gross.
I know. But I like when they go in the observation lounge and there are these kids and they're playing with the starships on the wall.
Yeah. And Riker yells at them, "Get out of here!
Scram!" Okay, so Riker's supposed to be like helping Picard project an image of geniality, right, with the kids.
Oh, that's right. Don't let me make an ass of myself around children.
So this is them trying for continuity, because you have Riker like jumping in and taking control, so that Picard can stand back and be captainly. But yeah, that's another thing that's kind of like really quickly dropped.
it is.
I guess they're in there so that they can leave the Chinese handcuff, so that we can make the mental, Chinese handcuffs, it's like the force field from the planet. And then we can have a joke at the end of the show. But it's like, really, guys, that should have been cut out in like, you know, draft three.
Right. And with in typical ADD fashion, the kids apparently left the Chinese handcuffs on the conference table because they were distracted by the shiny ships on the wall and they were over there playing with them.
Apparently.
Yeah. There's one thing I want to bring up about this is how these early TNG episodes, really not that much happens. I've been watching, I mean, even TOS, but I've been watching a lot of DS9 recently. And there's so much that happens in each of these episodes that when I go back to watch a first season TNG, it's like, okay, they went to the planet, there was a force field, they went down to the planet, they met the portal, it was resolved. That's like five total things. And they stretch it out by having every single character have their say. It's like they go and they stop. It's like, well, let's let Geordi say what he wants to do. Let's let Data say, Worf, Yar. Yeah, like Nurse Chapel shows up. She says what she wants to do. And
they're like, you're
Kim
not even stationed on this ship.
Like, what are you? You're Commodore Decker. You're supposed to be dead.
Everybody needs to take turns now.
Right.
And you know what the most amazing part is about that is that, yeah, they do get every single person's opinion except for the chief engineer. Now, why didn't Argyle give his opinion here?
He doesn't show up for this whole episode. I mean, they were culling down to engineering. No answer. He doesn't show up to the staff meeting.
Yeah.
He must be locked into the Jeffries tube. He locked himself in or something.
It's strange. I mean, I get that Gene wanted there to be different roles on this show than on the last one. But why would Starfleet go from chief engineer as like a main role? Like you see Scotty. Scotty's like running the bridge half the time when everybody else is on, you know, away on away missions. Why would Starfleet go from that to, I guess we've got a couple chief engineers. They say Argyle's one of our chief engineers. And he's not a guy that shows up at the staff meetings. Geordi goes down there and just takes over.
Yeah.
What happened in 100 years? Was there like a, I don't know, like a chief engineer strike and they brought in a bunch of scabs and now no one really wants to talk about engineering anymore? I don't have a good theory here.
I think that's what it was. And Argyle doesn't show up to staff meetings because he's drunk in the Jefferies tubes.
Right. Well, that's true.
He misses the announcements. I like in The Naked Now when they call down to engineering and McDougal and the Japanese guy, whose name I can't remember at the moment, they both look at each other like, is that you or me? Who's going up there?
That's what happens when you have more than one chief engineer aboard.
Right.
That's confusing. Who's really in charge here?
You got to pay attention to your plurals. Chief engineers to the observation
lounge,
please.
Apparently, it's Geordi in charge.
Picard's
like, walks in
hey,
there.
Wait, you're the helmsman, right? You steer the ship. Why don't you go down to engineering and see if you can't fix this?
Like, and he does.
That doesn't make...
Isn't it disconcerting that whenever you walk into engineering, it's empty?
Yes.
There's nobody in there. It's this giant starship. You've got matter and antimatter being mixed together to propel you through space at who knows how many times the speed of light.
Right.
And engineering is just... There's nobody there.
Yeah, it's either nobody or Wesley's like doing a science project.
Unsupervised in engineering next to the warp core.
Yeah, I know.
Like, oh, look, I created this super high-powered tractor beam that can cut through walls and fly chairs around the room. I'm going to go test it in engineering
while no one's there.
Right.
No harm in that.
Yeah, engineering is so weird. And when does Geordi get his promotion? Season 2, right?
Season 2.
Yeah, starting season 2, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's down there.
It's just...
Which is one of the best things, besides Riker growing his beard, one of the best things to happen to TNG is Geordi being promoted to chief engineer.
Yes, the poor guy. He finally gets something to do, and the engineering crisis is resolved.
Right.
Right. Plus, I love LeVar Burton, and I love Geordi, and... Mm-hmm. In that role of chief engineer, he's able to really shine as an actor and a character throughout the rest of the series.
Yes,
the way they use him in season one, it's just kind of like, oh, hey, look, it's the 24th century. Here's a blind guy who can still work with everybody else is basically how it plays.
But it's, weirdly enough, you know, again, reading Larry's book, LeVar Burton was like the name coming into this, because he had just done Roots.
Yeah, right.
Nobody knew who Patrick Stewart was in the States.
Yeah.
It's basically Will Wheaton and LeVar Burton
were the
names going into it. So I don't know why they relegated him to being helmsman. It seems like they knew right off the bat that they wanted to use him for important stuff.
Yeah, I don't know why they finally selected him for that character, but at least they didn't cast Wesley Snipes, which apparently was one of the options that was under consideration. That would have been
interesting.
Well, like you said, Greg, there's not a whole lot that happens in this episode, really. One of the things that is introduced here, which I think could have been interesting for them to explore throughout the series, or at least the first season, is this idea of the T'Kon Empire. If you think back to something, you know, like... Isaac Asimov's Foundation, for example, where you have this gigantic galactic empire, that the idea that there was long ago this enormous empire that spanned 600,000 light years that then collapsed. It's an interesting idea, but they really don't do anything with it. Even in this episode, they don't do anything with it.
Yeah.
And then they never come back to it. But what do you think about that concept and where maybe they could have gone with it.
Well, it's interesting that Picard's never heard of them. Like, apparently he fell asleep during that history class or something. That they weren't talking about France, so he zoned out.
That's right.
Yeah.
I only come to the French days.
Right. But no, it's really, really quite interesting that, they're the idea that societies have progressed and gone down over the centuries. And it's actually kind of weird that at this point, the Federation is the height of technological whateverness. Because, I mean, the Ferengi had been developing for, what, twice as long? And they had only reached the level of the Federation at this point. Even the Vulcans don't seem to be ahead of where Earth is, or the Klingons or the Romulans. Why are none of these societies that were around for hundreds of thousands of years, why are none of them still around and kicking and like actual dangerous adversaries?
That's a good question. Natural disaster?
Right. And apparently, yeah, apparently they were hit by a JJ supernova. Right. It can destroy
yes.
trillions of people on hundreds and thousands of planets.
Right, yes. Except for this one that's still right. left somehow.
Yes, this, well, they say that this was their most distant outpost. But,
right.
Yeah, yes. I immediately thought, now obviously a supernova, I mean, it can have an effect. It can destroy a planetary system. It can sterilize, you know, the gamma rays, the gamma radiation that's emitted. If it's directed at a particular planet, even a planet that's very, very far away, you know, it could sterilize the planet. Yeah, sure, mm-hmm. that can happen. But this is supposed to be an empire that spans 600,000 light years. How is this empire, how did it fall due to a single supernova? I didn't quite get that. You would expect them to still be around.
Lots of
red matter. It was a red matter supernova. The entire supernova was made of red matter.
Yeah.
There we go. There we go.
Maybe that's how they got red matter.
It was like a giant space loogie that flew through the Tron Empire. A red space loogie.
A giant space loogie of red matter.
All right.
There's a visual in HD for you.
Oh, man. Well, and then, okay, so there we have this last outpost with the portal inside of it. Like, what is the concept here? Like, he was... Like, who is he supposed to be? Who is this guy that they end up meeting on the surface? He's not an actual person, right? He's like a computer image.
He's like a desk clerk.
I never quite figured that out.
It's like going down to the DMV to get a driver's license. Because...
Okay.
I was actually surprised when he finally materializes and he's like, ooh, bipedal, nice, or something like that. And
right.
then he's like, so.
Yeah.
I can work with that.
That's right. then he tells Riker, so you want to submit your application to the Empire?
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess every one of these distant outposts has this one guy that stayed there to accept applications to the Empire. And I guess he stamps them. They're in triplicate. He stamps them. He sends them off to the home world. And then I guess you wait 6,000 to 8,000 years and you find out if you got
right.
accepted into the Empire or not.
Yeah, you're right. That is the DMV, isn't it?
Yes.
I suppose that makes sense.
Yes.
But the whole thing with the blade too, where he's like shoot right by Riker's
yeah.
head.
Yeah,
I guess that was but the yeah. test. You are being tested, Commander Riker.
Right.
How do you know my name?
Yeah,
right. It's like
never mind the weapon
not,
right by my head.
Yeah, and I guess we're jumping past much stuff. But I want to talk about the Takan Empire. Like, what is their MO? Like, they seem to be peaceful ish because. You know, at the end of it, they're not impressed by the Ferengi. They are impressed by the Federation guys. So we think of an empire as being somebody who goes out and conquers, but they don't seem to be much in the way of conquering. But then they were wiped out by a supernova, so they weren't that scientifically, you know, good because they couldn't see it coming. They couldn't stop it, even though they were around for 600,000 years.
Right. You'd think they'd somewhere in space travel to where, you know, they could build a ship and go away.
Right. Like, why isn't there, like, anybody from the Takan Empire still around. And maybe if they had returned to this in a later episode, we would have met, like, you know, a planet, like a Takan planet that's still kicking.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so.
It kind of reminds me of a couple things. So from TNG itself, I think of the Takan Empire being a bit like the Iconians who come up in Contagion. And then we see them again in DS9, actually, in To the Death, we see the Iconians again, because they actually had gateways even, you know, into the Gamma Quadrant. And
right.
That type of, like, galaxy-spanning, very, very advanced technology empire that was able to kind of traverse the galaxy at will, that's kind of, just in this brief moment, is how I always pictured the Takan Empire, and it's why I would like to see them go back to it. You know, I think of it like in the Carl Sagan's Contact, when you have the wormhole right. transportation network, and no one knows who built it, but it's just there. Stephen Baxter in his Manifold series has a similar thing where they use these sort of blue portals in space to kind of traverse.
Oh, that's true.
Both through the galaxy and time. And for some reason, just from the last outpost here, I've always thought of the Takan Empire in that same way.
Yeah.
And I've always been disappointed that we didn't explore it.
It's sort of like how on Earth used to be like dinosaurs everywhere. And then now we've got these weird mammal creatures running around. It's sort of the idea that, you know, the world has these cycles, that the Takan Empire is running things for a little while. Then the Federation gets to run things for a little while. And one of these days, we're going to be gone too. And there's going to be somebody else who comes along and, you know, finds our outposts and is very confused.
Maybe so. Yeah, maybe our lizard future people will come back and, what is all this stuff?
That's right. And they'll say,
you never know.
This has all happened before, and it'll all happen again.
So say it all!
That's right. That's right.
There you go.
Oh. So that's the Takan Empire. I don't know. Do you have other thoughts on it? My biggest thoughts were I pictured it as being this big thing that there's so much potential there that they could have mined as a thread,
right.
You know, through TNG and... Yeah, and it was, just, and I wonder if it had come up in like the fourth or fifth season, if maybe they would have used it in that way. But at this point, they're still very much into these individual TOS style shows.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, like the Metrons never really came back after. I mean, they were a big deal. Like they were the ones holding the peace between the Federation and the Klingons. But you're not going to see them mentioned going forward. It's only, you know, one of these non-canon novels where they actually get mentioned.
Do you picture, like, there's some kind of convention in the past where, like, the Iconians and the Takan guys and the Metrons and those pre-humanoid guys from The Chase, like, they all get together. They all have, like, their own little staff meetings a million years ago.
There you go. Hey, here's a good idea for the animated series. Like, don't set it in the far future. Set it in the far past and... Let's follow the Takan Empire and see what they're up to.
There you go.
Could actually be interesting.
That'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah. All right. Well, once we get down to the planet, this is where it just all falls apart to me.
Yeah,
and I have to tell you, I was watching this last night, and my son, who's not really in Star Trek yet, he is sitting over there next to me doing something on his iPod, and I had started laughing, and he was giving me a look because, you know, I've seen my wife sometimes will start laughing uncontrollably to the point where she's actually crying and can't catch her breath. And I rarely get like that, but by the end of The Last Outpost, I had tears in my eyes. And I just couldn't go on. Actually, Greg, I sent you an iMessage with like 10 of those smiley faces with tears shooting out of its eyes.
Yeah,
and
did.
I said, I can't watch this. And I just completely lost it because, and it was building up and building up. And finally, there's that bit at the end where the portal guy and Riker are just talking to each other directly. And where everything's being resolved. And I couldn't pay any attention to them because in HD, you can see so clearly off in the background. These Ferengi are still jumping around in the background, and it's the only thing that I can see. And everything in the foreground is just, I can't pay any attention to it. And I just lost it. I was just on the floor. And I have seen this episode so many times, but in standard definition, where that's all kind of fuzzy back there, never got to me. But boy, this was just quite an experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think they could have used the same script but done different things down on the planet. Like, it's a bad idea to have the Ferengi in the shots, like, so much.
So much,
like,
yeah.
Cut to them.
Yes, it's cut, like, to them.
Make it so you can cut to them and then cut back.
But they're, like, it's, in every shot.
Yeah, they're in every shot. And they're really, and they overtake what's going on. Like, there actually is some interesting stuff going on in the conversation between the portal and Riker.
Yes.
And actually, I find it interesting, and it works with me, works for me for how the Ferengi are, that they're sort of saying, well, but he's actually lying to you, and we're trying to, like, that's kind of perfect Ferengi.
Yes.
But the way they play it, and the fact that they're so much, like, it's the term horseradish character, which is a character that should be around just a little bit, not too much, because it sort of overpowers it. The Ferengi in this one are really, really strong horseradish. And they didn't realize it when they were filming, unfortunately. But it's so obvious, going back and looking at this, that they should have been in 10, 15 fewer minutes of the episode.
Exactly. So they're like wasabi characters. Right, they are beyond the horseradish character.
And there you go.
It's just it is a problem, because it's like, if the camera turns, I just picture the Ferengi, like, running to the other side so they can beat in the shot. In the
background. Exactly.
They're like tapping each other on the shoulder, like, oh, over there, over there, and then they all go over there.
Yes, and they do their weird creepy crawly thing. Make sure they get in the shot, and you know what? Yeah, it really is laughable. I wish the listeners could see what Chris is doing right now.
Oh my
God. Really is pathetic, because they have the set here. And I think that's kind of laughable as it is. I mean, it's very obviously fake. You've got this planet of, like, dilithium crystal foam rocks that Data was really interested in. Kind of unusual. And then you've got the Ferengi just dancing around and gesturing. And what the heck?
Speaking of the foam rocks, I like it when Riker and Data walk up to those, and Riker says, "So, Mr. Data, what do you make of these?" And Data says, "Crystalline." Like, they're giant crystals. They're the biggest crystals I've ever seen in my life. I know they're crystalline.
Doesn't he say nothing to write home about, too?
He does. Nothing to write home about.
Which is hilarious, because earlier, like, in the scene prior, he's investigating them or something, and he's like petting them or something. It's really weird. He's petting the crystal rocks.
So, let me just say that about the Ferengi. So, but Greg, you have a really great point, that I told you that I don't think I've ever seen such a disconnect between the words being delivered and the delivery of the actors. Because what the Ferengi are saying in this episode is really important, and it's really serious. And it's classic Star Trek, and it's classic Roddenberry.
Yeah.
And there's a really good point to it all. But it's all lost in the delivery. And I just want to go, and slap Richard Kalla, who is the director of this episode. Like, don't you understand what you're directing here? Read the words. Think about the meaning. Why are you telling them to act like some kind of space monkeys and mimes and a giant crate of acid or something? I don't know why. It's all, like, merged together in a transporter accident. Like, there's such a disconnect, and it really spoils it, because, the concept of this episode is not bad. It just gets spoiled there. And it's too bad, because I really was trying to listen to what they were saying, and I was so distracted that I just couldn't. Yeah.
Well, I think it really does speak to the fact that they gave it to a one-time director. I mean, obviously, they never invited him back. But when you've
can't
got it really matters, the director. Like, you can put all, you can cast it as well as you can write it as well as you can, but unless the people there making it understand what you're going for, it's really just going to fall apart. Like, I mean, if they'd had Livingston direct this, even Bull, I think it would have been a really good episode because all of the elements are there.
Yeah.
It's a little silly. I mean, there's silly bits here and there. You can make fun of Geordi and the data bits. But really, there's a good episode of Star Trek in this.
Yeah, I agree. There definitely was potential.
Yeah.
But something along the way did get messed up.
I do like how they have this Planet Hell set that they always go to that's got like these big styrofoam rocks. Like, it never feels real to me.
No. They just change the color of the paint of the rocks.
Right. And they change the color of the backdrop. I mean, they do it on TOS as well. But it's kind of almost a little bit more understandable on the original series because it's just...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the 60s and they don't have much money and... Okay. But on this show, really, couldn't you try going on location? I mean, they do it eventually. There's episodes where they do go on location.
Well, they have a much bigger budget. I mean, they started out with $1 million per episode budget, and then that got kicked up to 1.5. But that's a big... I mean, that 500,000 makes a really big difference in what you can do.
Well, Larry does say that they were making episodes in the fifth season on the same budget they were making first season episodes.
Yeah.
They had just...
They had materials that they could reuse. Mm. And they could put the money... They weren't having to create everything from...
Yeah.
Like they were in the beginning. So, yeah. All right. Well, that's the last outpost. So, anything else that we didn't touch on here that that you want to touch on? Any other thoughts on the remastering?
I did want to talk a little bit more about the Ferengi. And so I went back and watched... I've been watching DS9 and I've been skipping over most of the Ferengi episodes because I feel like the Ferengi kind of took over that show from time to time, and I don't like the episodes. Quark's really good, though.
Oh,
I think we can all agree
Quark is
a fantastic character.
Armin Shimmerman is fantastic. Absolutely.
Yeah, and of course, he's in this, and he's not bad.
Right.
But aside from all that, I watched Little Green Men today. And, like, okay, there's the Ferengi. That's what the Ferengi should have been. They're capitalists. They're always, you know, they go into the past, and they're going to try to figure out how to make a buck or make a bar of platinum.
Right.
Whatever it is. And I'm trying to, I want to ask you guys what you think of the transition. Like, is it believable that the Ferengi in this episode are the same Ferengi that we know in DS9?
No.
Chris, you're shaking your head.
I mean, the seeds are planted here that the Ferengi are involved in commerce. They're looking for ways to make a profit. It is brought up here, it is established here, but it doesn't actually come to fruition until Quark on Deep Space Nine, and that's really developed. You know, we see the Ferengi here and there. They do silly things like kidnapping Troi and Lwaxana, and
right.
You know,
this, oh, Jesus.
Yeah. There are the few moments here, but yeah, the Ferengi really don't come into their own until DS9, and I don't even, for me, this is just, yeah, this is where the Ferengi were introduced and we saw them. I actually don't even think about the Ferengi on the Next Generation very much. You know, they show up in the Price where they're bidding on that wormhole, and then the two of them get lost in the Delta Quadrant, who later we find in Voyager on False Prophets. And that was a nice little tie-in that Voyager did. A way to get the Ferengi on Voyager that made sense within the continuity of Star Trek, unlike what Enterprise did. But yeah, I don't think about much. And these guys in The Last Outpost, most definitely, to me, are not connected.
It kind of works for me. If I think of it that they hadn't met the Federation, and they didn't understand what they had to do to impress the Federation. Because obviously they want to be in this larger world. And so they were starting out trying to be threatening and crazy.
crazy is a good word for it.
Yes.
I think it's very possible that the Ferengi culture advanced, like, considerably, like, the moment they met the Federation. I mean, if you listen to what happens later on, we find out that they bought warp technology.
Yes.
They didn't develop it themselves.
Right.
So while they were a very old, ancient culture that had been developing, they were developing really, really slowly. I think once they met the Federation, it sort of kicked them into overdrive. Because by the time of DS9, they're sort of on the same level. So it kind of works for me in that way. If you think of these guys as being like primitive Ferengi, and that first contact really did a lot of good for them. However, yeah, watching it is still pretty painful.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are a very rough version of what became the Ferengi we know and love. That much is for certain. And I like to think that these goofy sea monkeys are just kind of like rogues of the Ferengi we eventually get to know.
Could be.
They've been out in space a little bit. They got a little crazy, a little kooky. Yeah, space travel was kind of getting to them a little bit, maybe. Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the Grand Nagus, when they got back to Ferenginar, the Grand Nagus sort of like slapped them down, like, why did you guys act like monkeys? Why are you being so silly? Rah, rah. Hitting them with the Nagus staff.
Right. Not bonk. A whip, the staff.
Bonk, right. Bonk on the head.
Do you think the staff like can shoot lasers like the laser whips can?
Maybe.
I'm sure.
That would be pretty cool. You just like hit it a couple times and then boom.
It probably has a retractable whip.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be pretty cool. We haven't actually talked about the whips. It's not a terrible idea, right? It's like a whip that shoots laser. It's a pretty bad idea.
It's an interesting
they
idea.
Use them again, right? They use them in Enterprise.
They use them in Enterprise.
Like, we see the laser whips,
yeah.
And it works a lot better.
Well, the whips look a lot better in Enterprise.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it's not a terrible idea. It's not my favorite weapon. I think the whips by themselves maybe are okay. I think the fur and the whips together is a little bit much. Like, I feel like Tobias is going to take me down to the gothic asshole. It's a little little Arrested Development reference there. So.
Yeah, it is a little kinky.
Yeah, a little bit.
Maybe these are very kinky Ferengi.
Maybe
again,
these are kinky
Ferengi. Space travel's getting to them. They're very lonely.
Right.
They gotta do what they gotta do.
They've got the fur going on and the... Yeah, there's something going on here.
Yeah, all they need is the ball gag, and I think they're set.
Oh, gosh. We made it 55 minutes.
I'm so sorry.
I should have known. I mean, laser whips and ball gags. Got to expect that that's where it's going to go.
What did you expect out of me? Damn it, you guys.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, gosh. So anyway, Greg, no, I think, so...
How about that Chinese finger trap, huh?
No, but to your point, Greg, I'm kind of halfway with you on that. I think that certainly the idea that the Ferengi looking for a way to manipulate someone to make a profit would be trying to figure out, like, how do we have to behave towards the Federation to get what we want? And the first thing they tried was acting like monkeys. And I can see them back on the ship afterwards having their own little staff meeting and saying, you know, this monkey shtick, it just didn't work very well. So next time we meet the Federation. But that makes sense to me, sure. The idea that first contact with the Federation kicked them into overdrive, that idea basically works for me. But... between this time and the DS9 time, we're only talking like 7 or 8 years. And I just don't think personally that that's enough time to make that drastic change within the society. So for me, that idea
not much time.
On that time scale probably doesn't work.
That's very true.
But the general concept, that first contact, especially if they look for ways to manipulate the society over time, they can adapt a new approach And it, the main thing is the technological aspect of it. I think it's not enough time. Unless, like you said, I mean, we do know that they bought their warp capability. Mm-hmm. So yeah, sure. Maybe they go and they buy all this other, you know, they, it's like they decide they're going to pump all this latinum into their economy and they're going to go out and they're going to buy all this other technology. So yeah, maybe.
I'm just saying, there could easily be a non-canon novel where these guys go back to Franganar and they just have this big Ferengi symposium where they just try to figure out what they're going to do. Because obviously, as you say, the Ferengi shtick's not working.
They probably do. And I'm sure that that novel does, in fact, exist.
I hope it does. I should look for it.
Somewhere. It's out there.
All right. Well, I think we've covered about everything we can cover today anyway about the Ferengi and this. So any final thoughts?
Yes. I thought it was incredibly odd at the very end of the episode. Crusher looks over to Captain Picard and calls him Jean.
Yes.
Yeah.
I noticed
that. Not Jean-Luc. Jean. And with this very lustful, weird-looking gaze, and they're supposed to be dying, and it's very weird.
Well, you know, in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Greg, you said, or maybe it was at the beginning of the show, you said that we finally found an episode that doesn't have any sex in it, but we don't know what happened on that bridge.
That is very true. So,
this is very true. I mean, they were trying to stay warm, right?
Right. They were trying to stay warm.
That's always one of those things when a starship, it like loses power and everything starts going down. It happened in a Starship Down where you've got Bashir and Dax sort of huddling together. You don't know what happened between when they started huddling and when they get found. Yeah, and I start to wonder here as well, like, did the bridge just go for it, just the whole bridge?
And how many times did we find Miles and Bashir in that situation together in DS9 episodes?
Again, we just don't know.
Probably don't want to know. Miles, nah. There's a few too many times when Miles just straight up said he wished he was married to Bashir rather than Keiko.
Like, well, do you blame him?
I know, I get it. Like, I totally, I'm on board with him. But you don't just say that out loud. You think it. You keep it inside. That's all I'm saying.
Get a filter, Miles.
I think that was a symptom of a bad marriage right there.
Oh, man.
Bad marriage. Oh, or goodness. Maybe O'Brien was really gay and was just coming to terms with that. Who knows?
Well, you know, it is a good point. I did notice that here, though, that Beverly calls him Jean. But you get that here, too, in the Naked Now. Troy calls Riker Bill, which I think two times that she
just
calls him
weird.
Bill. Yeah. At least she didn't call him Billy.
Well, that was supposed to be the idea. He was supposed to be called Bill by his female acquaintances. And then they sort of just completely dropped that happily because I don't think it works.
I don't think so.
I'm so glad they dropped that.
Yeah. All right. Any final thoughts from you, Greg?
No, I think we've pretty much covered it. There is the moment where nearing the end of the episode where they are all dying on the bridge and Riker isn't really in a rush to save them. Like he's just sort of casually having a conversation with the portal and there's this weird disconnect between like everyone suffocating and then Riker having this, you know, making like a speech. I don't know if that jumped out at you guys, but it's like there's kind of like a time crush here, guys. Like you got to explain, like there's bad stuff going on up there. We got to hurry up this whole philosophical discussion thing.
The way I saw it was that Riker wasn't aware of what was happening on the Enterprise because they'd cut out communications to save energy. So he was none the wiser.
Yeah, they did have the energy was cut, which again is very obvious in the remastered version where you can really see the models really, really clearly and you can see how dark all the windows and engines are. More so than in the original release of it. But what I liked was the way that the portal just kind of moved his hand and he said, they're released. And then all the power comes back on. So,
yay.
It's magic. Good old TNG season one magic.
Yeah.
So, Char, of course, everyone can find you on Trek FM, but tell everyone where else they can find you on the internets.
All right. Well, I do a podcast called The Delta Quadrant, and you can find me there discussing episodes of Star Trek Voyager, much as I do on Trek FM. And you can also find me on Twitter. My personal account is Oh the Profanity.
I think you need more.
Makes me chuckle every time I hear.
You need more enthusiasm in that, though.
Oh, the profanity!
That's right.
There you go.
Type that in to your computer now. All right. Well, thanks for joining us as always, Char.
Well, as always, thanks for having me back. It's fun.
Thanks, Charbear.
Love you too, Greg Unit.
Well, that's probably one of the cleanest features we've had with Charlene. Not quite sure how we managed to steer clear of the clear sexual innuendo all throughout The Last Outpost.
Well, it was kind of like driving a car. It's like no matter how good your tires are, if it's a rainy day and you drive long enough, eventually you're going to slide off the road, which I think we did.
I love having Charlene on. I'm glad we were able to talk about the Blu-ray a little bit. Obviously, our next several TNG features are going to be about the Blu-ray. Might be for the rest of forever because they're going to keep releasing these sets. So we sort of have our MO ahead of us. I'm astonished with the quality of the Blu-ray. It's just, I thought TOS looked good, but seeing this with a, you know, higher quality film stock and higher quality sets and costumes, seeing that in HD and then seeing the remade effects, I don't think I've ever seen effects that look this good. Maybe if you go back and watch like a restored print of 2001 in 70 millimeter, you're going to be like really, really blown away. But I'm just really impressed with what the guys at ILM and even the smaller shops that took over, what they were able to do on a TV budget.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you talk about TOS, and yeah, TOS looked great remastered, you know, in terms of quality of the picture and everything. But what astonishes me about this one is knowing that all this detail was there from the beginning.
I know.
Knowing that they that much effort into it really means something.
I mean, TOS kind of exposed some flaws from time to time. Like, we were able to see, like, the makeup's a little weird sometimes, the set's a little chintzy. You're not seeing flaws exposed with the TNG remastered. I really feel like you're not. You're only seeing better the artistry that was put into it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not sure if I think of the TOS ones as flaws as much as I think of them as limitations of they were able to do. But even on, you know, the TNG budget, and this was still in the 80s, they had a lot of limitations facing them as well. And to see that they put so much effort into the details is very impressive to me.
Yeah.
And being able to see it now, I'm glad that their work is being recognized. So,
definitely.
All right. Well, let's tell everyone where they can contact us if they want to let us know what they think about The Last Outpost, TNG Remastered, anything else we talked about, what costume you should wear to Las Vegas next year. Right. So just go to trek.fm/contact. You can send us a message through there. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, on Google Plus at hyperchannel/trekfmgplus, and of course on Twitter at username trekfm. And I should point out, Greg, that not only are you and I now tweeting from the Trek FM account, but Charlene and Drew are now tweeting from the Trek FM account as well. It's kind of a big decision for us to have multiple people tweeting from the account. But we want to be able to have more interaction with all of our listeners and followers. And it's difficult, you know, just for you and me to do it. It's especially difficult for me being in Japan because when it's my daytime, it's nighttime there for everyone. So we hope everyone enjoys having a few more people to talk to about Star Trek on there.
Yeah. Yeah. And watch for the -D or the -Char, and that'll help you know who it is that's talking. And don't be surprised if you get multiple responses from the Trek FM account if you write to us. Sometimes Chris and I will have almost identical responses, but we'll sign them so you'll know who's talking back to you.
Right.
But we're all going to be on there reading your replies. Really enjoy the interaction we're able to have with people through the Trek FM account. So yeah, I'm glad to have Drew and Char on as well. Char was talking today about Deadlock, which is one of my favorite Voyager episodes. So if you missed that live tweeting, definitely go back and check it out.
Yeah, I enjoy live tweeting my episode watches. I hope that the followers enjoy that too. We do get a lot of feedback from people when we do it. So I think some people enjoy that. All right. Well, Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. I'm there at Greg Harbin. And yeah, I don't even know what I'm talking about recently. I'm actually having a lot of just interactions with all the people who are at Vegas and around the world, just talking a lot about Star Trek. I've had a lot of fun over the last week just having conversations with people. And the rest of it has just been, you know, little jokes here or there.
Well, speaking of just, you know, little conversations on Twitter, Greg, that's pretty much my use of Twitter as well. So everyone, you can find me on Twitter at C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And I am actually finally getting back to just straight out tweeting a fair bit like I used to, which I haven't been doing much the past few months. Tweeting about Japan a lot, things I see. I had a great time doing a live commentary of a damaged seat on the train the other day and watching how many people
that was a lot of fun.
Would sit there or not sit there. It was like material draped over the seat with newspaper underneath it and a plastic liner, which I don't know. and it was quite comical.
Oh, man.
So anyway, that Star Trek, of course, college football season is about to start. So all kinds of stuff. So give me a follow. If you follow me, send me an at reply. Let me know you followed me. Say hello. I generally have conversations, so I'm tweeting back and forth with people. And so I love to talk to everyone. So let me know. All right, Greg. Well, I think we'd better let people get on with their days here. This show is running pretty long. So
you've had your breakfast, you've had your coffee, you've had your ready room. It's time to go to work, guys.
That's right. I've got some things I need to do myself. Like, for example, right now, I'm going to wander on down to engineering and see if there's anybody down there.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick a Chinese handcuff in it, because the ready room is done.
Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we monkey around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down.